So kicking off Ovalle's 471st open mic, wow, we have Trish Mannion.
This is actually a short story. The Stead. It all happened after a night on the town and a kind of pre-wedding bash. You couldn't call it a hen night or a stag night because both Jim and Helen were on the same night out. I thought that was a bit odd, but they assured me that no, it was a great idea because they shared everything and were really excited about sharing the rest of their lives together. They called it a stem. Give me a break. Their saccharine sweet carry-on was giving me a toothache. And now I had to go on an enormous group date, or at least that's what it sounded like to me. The wedding was on the 3rd of June, the wedding month, for those of you who don't know. Marry in the month of June and life would be one long honeymoon. And to be sure that they'd be perfect on their big day, the Sten was to be exactly 4 weeks before on the 13th of May. Everyone who was invited to the wedding was invited to the Sten. I tried to get out of it, but it was impossible. I worked with Jim and Helen was my sister's best friend. They knew so much about me that I couldn't make up a decent lie that wouldn't be able to see through. We met up in the Radisson, only the best for our Jim and Helen, at 7:30 for drinks and finger food, followed by speeches from the soon-to-be bride and groom. The night was organised by the best man and the main bridesmaid, or at least that's what we were all supposed to be. But actually, Helen organised the whole thing herself. My sister told me that Helen confided in her that she didn't think anyone could do as good a job as her, so why risk it? Now, you may remember that I said my sister Anna was Helen's best friend, so surely Anna was chosen as the chief bridesmaid. Not so. It seems Anna's fondness for cream buns made her unsuitable bridesmaid material for Helen. Jim, on the other hand, did have his best friend as his best man. Jim and Andrew had been friends since they were children. They'd gone to school together, they'd shared flats together, they'd been joined at the hips for years, so naturally, Andrew would be Jim's best man. The night was going fine, better than I'd expected really, so instead of sneaking off at the earliest chance I got, I hung around. I'm not much of a drinker, well, that's to say, I probably shouldn't drink at all, but straight my head. Though it has to be said, I am very cracked with a few on me. The night started with free champagne, and then everyone got hooked on the cocktails. Cocktails were never my thing, but how can you look a gift horse in the mouth? By 11 o'clock, everyone was plastered. It was at this stage that Helen decided to declare her love for Jim. She waxed lyrical about his wonderful sense of humour, his honesty, his good looks, his gentle and honest nature, his great job, and so on. Then it was Jim's turn to return the compliment, but Jim was nowhere to be seen. Neither was Andrew. To fill the embarrassing silence, good old Anna tried to save the day by asking us all to tell Helen truthfully how we felt about her. Everyone was saying the same old drivel of how much they loved her, how they knew she was going to be the perfect bride, etc., etc. Then it came to my turn. I don't know what happened, but I just couldn't go along with all the crap. Maybe it was because Anna was being so nice to Helen, whereas Helen was being a right bitch to her. Or maybe it was just that I couldn't be arsed going along with the charade any longer. So I just told her, and anyone listening, what I thought of the wonderful Helen. I explained to her that she was the most manipulative person I'd ever met, and that I'd never liked her. This could have come as no surprise to her, as I knew she felt the same about me. The only reason I'd been invited was to keep Anna company, kind of like a compensation prize for not being bridesmaid. I must have been on a roll at that stage because I then told her that I'd never met two people less suited to each other as herself and Jim were. That she was the most shallow person I'd ever met. And then, as a final shot, I told her where her precious Jim was and who he was with. The gasps from the room at my final statement made it clear to me that I'd probably gone a tad too far. Okay, maybe I had gone a bit far, but Jesus, I was only saying what everybody else was thinking. There could be no doubt that this was a marriage of convenience. It was convenient that Jim had a great job, and even more convenient that he owned his own house in a very prestigious area of town. It was a little less convenient that Jim had more interest in Andrew than he was ever likely to have in Helen. Oh, for God's sake, why does everyone have to take everything so seriously? I was a bit out of it at the time, and she'd never have been asked to voice my opinion on anything. I've been uninvited to the wedding, and Jim's not quite so friendly at work anymore. They didn't want to hear my opinion, why was I asked? Jesus, get over it. I was drunk.
Thank you very much. I think we've all been there. I won't elaborate. Not until the next point, anyway. Sue Cosgrove, who's going to give us another short story piece as well, I believe.
Oh, okay.
This is the continuation of a story I read a few weeks back called In the Attic. And it's a story of a couple, a young couple in the Soviet Union in the 1970s, living in a tenement flat, and there's strange knocks in the attic. Days went by, then weeks. March turned into April. The days were getting longer. Each morning, Anyushka played games with the children in the kindergarten. They recited the alphabet together, and one day she showed them how to finger paint. When little Svetlana painted a red star above a bright green tree, she praised her and pinned the drawing to the achievements board. When Misha drew a tank, even though it looked like a gray boulder, she also praised him and told him he was a good boy. By night, Anyushka visited friends, went to the kino with Kolya, or sat by the window drinking glass upon glass of strong sugary tea. And always, somewhere at the periphery of her vision, those frozen little fingers waved. Come closer, they seemed to say. Come closer, touch us. The thoughts in the attic continued. Sometimes they were extraordinarily persistent. She went across to see, The thoughts in the attic continued. Sometimes they came singly, other times in quick succession, like Morse code. You hear that? She would sometimes ask Kolya. They're dancing today. Kolya shrugged. Mostly he heard nothing and told her she was imagining things. One day when she was alone and the thoughts were extraordinarily persistent, she went across to Stepan Andreevich, the old drunk in number 9. She realized her mistake as soon as she asked him whether he too heard anything from above. For Stepan Andreevich, it transpired, heard everything, groans and shrieks and every imaginable thought and knock. He heard them everywhere, voices too. Anyushka sighed and turned to go, but he followed her out into the landing, his stale brandy and cabbage breath dancing, advancing on her. Just you wait, he shouted through her door. They'll come for you too. Where would you be then, eh? Anyushka was more annoyed than scared. Everyone knew Stepan Andreevich was harmless. She still found his ram disquieting. She could put her finger on it. Was it his eyes, she wondered, normally bleary and often tearful, but just now, not only were they focused, but quite the opposite of tearful. In fact, they were ablaze with a strange earnestness, as if he were addressing a kindred soul. He's just a sad old drunk, she tried to assure herself. But as soon as she heard him shut his door, and resolving to get to the bottom of it, whatever it happened to be, she slipped out again. Hurrying down the stairs, she nearly fell over Tatiana Fyodorovna, the yard keeper, who was halfway up the seventh flight. Goodness me, whatever the commotion, inquired the old woman on a gasp. Tatiana Fyodorovna's heavy breathing was a testament of how rarely she exerted herself, and to the haste with which she could move when her curiosity was aroused. Nothing to worry about, Tatiana Fyodorovna, just Stepan Andreevich ranting about nothing. I should have known. That's all these writer types are good for. A writer? How interesting. I never knew he was a writer. Not anymore he isn't, said Tatiana Fyodorovna as she turned and limped down the stairs, expelled from the writers' union a long time ago, and good riddance too. What was he expelled for? Asked Anyushka without thinking. Tatiana Fyodorovna's beady eyes swiveled to where Anyushka stood, one hand on the banister, her left foot frozen in mid-air. The crafty wariness in the old woman's eyes sent a shiver down Anyushka's spine. The look disappeared in an instant. I'm imagining things, said Anyushka to herself, but the old woman's face was once again benign and placid. Stooping to pick the broom from where she had left it drop. Come in for a glass of tea, my dear, she said to Anyushka. Would you prefer a glass of mushroom brew? Anyushka Obinki followed Tatiana Fyodorovna to her basement flat. Inside, the soul was gazing away, and Misha, the cat, slept curled in the chair beside it. On the kitchen table, the samovar was chugging steam into the air, which teased out every hidden smell. A whiff of bacon fat intermingled with that of wet woolen socks, and a hint of pickled cabbage wrestled for dominance with the overpowering smell of kerosene. Tatiana Fyodorovna removed her fur hat and unclasped her shawl, her dangly ruby earrings sparkled in the dim overhead light. It's about the attic, said Anyushka. The attic? Yes, something must be broken. It's banging against the floor. A pipe, or maybe even a plank of wood falling from the ceiling. Perhaps you could go up there and take a look. Even as she said this, Anyushka realized the absurdity of her words. She giggled in spite of herself. Tatiana Fyodorovna smiled as she handed Anyushka a glass of tea, pushed a saucer of lumps of sugar towards her. Whatever for, Tatiushka? There's nothing up there. No pipes or anything. It's been empty for years. But the noise, Tatiana Fyodorovna, sometimes it goes on for hours. Nonsense, Tatiana Fyodorovna exclaimed. But could you mind the dress? When Matvey comes around, I'll send him to you. On that note, she adroitly changed the subject, for the handyman Matvey was not the only one that had to be sent around. There was gossip, too. Oi, that Dusa who lives across the way, and that turnip cabbage face Marina in number 3, both pregnant by Slava, the one that works in the ladies' department in the GUM. The commotion this morning when Marina saw him coming out of Dusa's flat, and had Anyushka heard? Shura, the old woman who comes around with the flowers, found hanging this morning. 72 she was, and no one to bury her. All her children dead. The last one in Novosibirsk, that accident a year ago. Speaking of which, rumor going around they will be selling light bulbs in the hair and hairbrushes in the shop next week. But don't go telling anyone, we'll be killing each other in the queues. My legs can't take that standing anymore. Arthritis. If it wasn't for the mushroom brew, I'll petrify like a trunk in sunlight. And by the way, while I have you here, any more strange goings on in number 4? All very suspicious, if you ask me. What could they be talking about all night, And not a drop of vodka to wet their throats. No singing, no music. You hear anything, my dear, you let me know right away.
So I'm going to ask Philip Spillane to come next, because you've also got a small short story piece, really, really short, and then we'll get on to the actual poetry at our weekly poetry event. So Philip, quick as you can.
Thank you. So I'm working on a horror story, and I'm going to try this out and I'm going to see what you guys think. I'm going to read like the first abstract of the first part. And it's called The Whites of the Hilltop Mountain. I hope you like it. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what to know. You probably won't believe me, but I tell you it's true. I went up that hill and came down a different man. A man that once had experience and confidence. I was Harry Page, a reporter. Everyone once called me Page. That's when I was brave. That's when I was young. When I was bold. And I went up a hill to risk falling back down, faceless, maskless, mistaken, sinned, and cursed. The signs were painted on every step I took on that travel up. When I parked my car at the foot of the field and climbed over that gate, my shoes getting ruined by the swamp mud that forced me to wrench on through the long green till I reached the faint signs of steps. When I started, it rained. I climbed the 222 stones that were carved around the hill like it was a pillar holding a spiral staircase. A storm began. I crawled up the steps. So much water, so much cold. I remember vividly it was like climbing up against a waterfall. It gushed harshly against me, dribbling down the steps, forcing me back. And maybe I should have collapsed and slid along with the current. The rain was soaking me hollow. My heavy traveling clothes, my skin, my bones, my heart, all were wet and so cold. The rain never stopped falling. It made everything dark, me sick. My mind went into a trance for the sole purpose of reaching the top. The last step, which I shouldn't have stepped. A dark sign told me to turn back. I heard a clap and the sky lit white for a few seconds. But seconds before it was dark, full of rain clouds, internally shedding water on my weakened body. It was now flashing heavy, white for a millisecond before dulling. My eyes dazed, my numb face flexed in shock, and for the first alternative thought posed in my mind, dragons. It stopped happening. The skies turned back to dullness. The rains calmed, and I realized how much of a damp creature I was. I felt like a frog with wet, soggy skin. Shaking, my head pushed on to the manor house that appeared out of nowhere. I didn't take in any details. All I saw was a double door entrance with no handles. It was black door, and the only part that stood out was a silver letterbox soaked like tap that recently sprouted water. Climbing up the steps that led to the door, I lifted the cold letterbox to look in. Nothing was inside, just black. I knocked with my right hand. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip. All right, so I believe that ends our short story section of our weekly poetry event. So thank you, guys, and for being so swift. Next up, we have Samir.
Hi. So this is my five-word poem, which I didn't finish in time. I call it The Child of the Levant. Firepower surrounds her, the child of the Levant. In a cloud of malevolence lies the cradle of the West. The turbulence of firefights and cannon volleys through the night illuminates the nascent life of the child of the Levant. No shells from seas and ocean sounds, just shells that steal men's lives abound. Bombardments birth these shells to ground from choppers pregnant, filled with death. The friction between the West and her mother has led to this wretched matricidal murder. We all know whose hands are drenched in the blood of the child of the Levant.
Thank you.
To paraphrase Gandalf, that poem wasn't late, it arrived precisely when it meant. Thank you. Next up we have Stan Nutt. And Stan is organizing some volunteers, which I was supposed to mention earlier, for the Winter Warmer Festival. So if you like his poem, get in touch for volunteering. If you don't like his poem, get in touch for volunteering.
Kind of covers all bases, doesn't it? The Winter Warm was on the 25th and 26th of November. We're looking for people to give us a hand selling books and treacherous task of handing out mulled wine to dodgy patrons. If you're available for that, just give me a shout. Right, this is a new piece. This is, what do you say? It's written using print song titles. Obviously, on the day they thought I'd have a whack doing something for it. It's getting its first public open. You might never get another one. It's, I don't know what it says about me. It says nothing about Prince. Your feedback, you know, it says nothing about Prince. And if it does, Jesus, there'll be court cases. Anyway, your feedback is welcome. So it's called Darling Nikki. Darling Nikki, I love you. When I hear your voice, I count the days, each beginning endlessly, and heart in my hand, I walk in the sand while you touch my third eye. And the voice inside my head promises eternity, eternity, eternity. Darling Nikki, I love you. When we're dancing close and slow, I'm possessed by power fantastic. The sun, moon and stars tattoo. My love is forever in my heart, and all the midnights in the world sing a simple love song. You're the one for me. You're the one for me. You're the one for me. Darling Nikki, when I lay my hands on you, screams of passion segue at 100 miles per hour in my head. Black sweat and corrosion mixing, delirious overtures avalanche round and round my tender heart, my tender heart, my tender heart. Darling Nikki, I love you. When you call my name, scandalous orgasms thunder all day, all night. and I can't stop the insatiable, now everlasting truth. I'll always love you. I'll always love you. I'll always love you. Darling Mickey, how come you don't call me anymore? You know as long as we are together, planet Earth is a positive place. You know you want to see me. Call me, darling Mickey. Call me tomorrow. Call me tonight. Call me now. Darling Mickey, I always love you, but I don't trust you anymore. There's others here with us now. I know Johnny had you uptown, alone, for the doves spoke to me, and when doves cry, the circle of amour is broken. Darling Mickey, why do you want to treat me so bad? What did I say? Wasn't my faith undisputed, everlasting? Now the rest of my life holds no expectation. Dark clouds colour all my dreams, and when the lights go down, Kenophobia holds me skin tight in an empty room. An empty room. Damn you, darling Mickey, I hate you. I hate every part of you. I hate your pink cashmere raspberry beret, your super cute sugar walls, the gold ice ring castles on the couch where 1,000 hopes and kisses promise the future would feel good, feel better, feel wonderful. Damn you, darling Mickey, I don't care about tomorrow. I don't care about the future. I don't care, I can't stop the words I scream in this bed. What she wants is to die for you, die for you, die for you. Strolling around and around this empty room. Damn you, darling Mickey. The question, thrill you or kill you, is forever here, is forever here, is forever here. Shh, darling Mickey. Shh. God is standing at your side now, and I will die for you tonight. For a place in heaven is our destiny.
Wonderful stuff. Thank you, Stan. A lovely poem and a lovely tribute. If you do want to get involved, please do, for the Winter Warmer Festival. I'll personally be around to drink copious amounts of mulled wine, so someone will have to provide the copious amounts of mulled wine. So do sign up, it's a worthy endeavor. Ray Hanrahan, please.
We small few dedicated our presence to the memory of those who died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The little tribute called when compared to the atrocity unleashed 71 years ago, useless flowers compared to the heart. Yet we did it all the same, compelled to remember destruction on a scale so abominable it makes mere words redundant. To forget is to be unaware of the momentary terror by uranium and plutonium, idols of the atomic age.
Nice, thank you very much. It's always important to remember the past, lest we repeat the mistakes. Patricia Walsh.
And this is called Uncomplicated. Cheap cook and bottle washer I am not. Recharging swollen batteries for a decrepit current. Resurrecting fantasy gone before us. Perfection, so it seems, lies bleeding. Decimating the opposition, a smarmy glance. Hitting above par for spite inglorious. Consanguine us to a point, stalling destiny, too principled to go back to share fate. Returning to familiar desecration, changing minds a prerogative, deserving of its rot. Just being spiteful, a very pissed off heterosexual, waiting for the man in my only occupation. Word to moon and stairs, a cause for concern, suicide not an option for trivial persons. Cutting my teeth on hardware fantasy. Sated is yours and open to taking. Visitation de rigueur, copper fastened the divine. Division sleeping like a monstrous behemoth. If you read this, take note, install. I am trouble complicating towards a standstill. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Patricia. Okay, Benjamin Burns.
This is quite current. I don't know if there's any Pokemon Go players. I didn't think I'd ever write this poem. In the future, giant Pikachus with infinite IQs and highly developed senses of empathy will let the humans roam free across Silicon Valleys and permit them to gamble with plastic bag fish in the turgid radioactive seas. As they connect their nervous systems to the Earth's electromagnetic field and harness its spectral power to demystify the why of existence and lose themselves in the sight of the Aurora, and the priestess of the Pikachus will cast the ceremonial Pokeball away from herself to capture the abyss, and the universe will be born from the light that bursts forth from within. Pikachu!
Fair enough. Next up we have the Carlos.
Sometimes it's two, but this time
it's
one.
The Carlos. I know some Carlos, but apparently you're
the one. I'm the one.
Alright, fair enough. Okay, cool.
This poem has a refrain to it, so it doesn't matter what you say platonically, right?
What is the word?
Platonically, right.
I'm gonna do that.
Fuck Plato! And they did! There wasn't a bro or a hoe or a league nor a gentleman that didn't know there ain't no party like a Plato party. If you paid your cards just right, you might just find that we rolled with Athenians from both sides. They come from miles and miles to see how we philosophize about their spheres and sideways smiles. They form a line and watch them go, all on their way to fuck Plato! The only way to do anything really, not merely to go part way with a semi or skip a beat off and leave you high and dry, rocking Greece a while, the scholar would Socratically romance you with subtle eye contact and subtle communication style. He knew how to stay engaged with youths and maidens, singing songs and duet with recent egon sight you first only through your mind. Ever he sold out to play in the courts of every kind, and drove the boys and girls all wild, his good times were awesome, he screwed you the only way he knew to. Peter, he put his name to love that we now undersell. Not love, platonically, that's just not sexual, but actively transcends to be not just sexual. A love that doesn't come upon you all at once, but slow and gradual. That after talking dirty, there'd still be something more to talk about. Not just a saucy fur, but a deep and meaningful fool about. He knew the ins and outs of the old in and out, inside and out. His words filled you up before his... sorry, his words filled your brains up before he elsewhere fucked them out. Plato ruled, yes, one way or the other, and honor had to be told which way that he preferred. And if he and Sappho ever attended the same party, rooms divided back and front, it formed cues of his and hers. We better still stay longer, there's time for more than once with either. I said it not to be blunt, but Plato could talk your ear off about the boys who crave cock and the girls who crave cunt. So write poetry, fuckers, write fucking poetry, write cunnilingus, operatic, and fellatio oratory, write lyrics on the smell of your favorite clitoris, describe in detail how their sweet skin tightened around their testes. Bury your hungry pen 15 inches deep in the page, get notions, put the poor young scribes in English classes enraged, contemplating if you in your science describe better the complex emotions of taking your lover's love in the mouth or the ass, taking all your words absurdist and modernist. Fucking write poetry till your fucking vision fucking blurs. Hit a meter out of bone, write haikus about his toes. Write limericks about her nose. Write laments about the fucking you didn't do. Write ballads about how great I felt to hear them say your name between moans. And fucking write fucking poetry about fucking not fucking too. Write adventurous epics on fucking entire cities or about the courage it took to say a quick hello. Sing loud and proud about your lover's nice big titties. Write poetry about your lover's handsome dick. Fuck Plato!
Very nice, interesting poem. Okay, course, you would hate to be a world-renowned philosopher who's been studied for thousands of years, but whose name describes getting off with someone in a non-sexual way. I mean, he did lots of other cool things too, but there you go. Anyway, Phil.
This is actually a poem I wrote recently about sort of why I moved to Ireland. I don't have a name for it yet. I'm just getting over a chest infection. Sorry, my voice is going a bit. We were talking about that earlier, sleeping with a chest infection.
Yep.
Alright. When I drink with my father, I like to talk about religion. He's an agnostic, you see, a skeptic, and a Catholic. Of course, though, quick to remind you, an Irish one at that. For we had a famine, we bore genocides, so only we can criticize pedophile priests called pedophiles of era, or golden gilded, gown-wearing Roman consuls speaking of poverty in the 21st century. They cannot criticize, because those Freemason bastards hunted out priests like wolves, called Mocteer and Irish, and made us pay tithes to bastard landlords, and in the 20th century wore white hoods and capes in the American South, and cost Al Smith the election with burning crosses, mocking our silly rituals. This is how an agnostic clings coyly to Catholicism in the 21st century. When I was born out of wedlock, I was the cutest little thing. My fists balled up, and even when I bawled for my olive-skinned mother, mocked mercilessly for her big hair and Long Island ways, despite her Irish-sounding last name, I at least put a smile on people's faces. And when I was a toddler, learning still how to walk and to speak English, for the first time, the evil empire, far off in the east, collapsed, and my future seemed then, I'm sure, to my young parents, to hold so much promise, but they could not account, like think tanks in 2002, for the rise of non-state actors, as the dragon that my society donned its armor against was replaced in the dark forest by thousands of small snakes, hard to see and harder still to fight, and like a mugger lurking in alleyways at night, the hope and bright future was changed when 21 Sunnis flew some planes into some buildings, and unlike my father, whose war was waged on the streets of Queens against outsiders whose names didn't sound Irish, I would have a war to fight. And unlike the Soviet Union, who spent themselves to death winning the race to bankruptcy, my war would be one in which shots were fired. My father reaches over and pours me four fingers of Jameson's because he knows I have a tremendous thirst and I am the biggest, largest vendor of his family, the firstborn. The Kingdom of Kerry's flag flutters in the wind on the huge deck on which we sit in suburban Northern Virginia, a satellite community of Washington, D.C., which is where my father works and his girlfriend lives. I was doing some odd jobs at the time and staying at my father's house. I haven't made much money since getting out of the army, and it's very easy to feel as though you have peaked, even that young, when you go from Iraq and Afghanistan back to waiting tables for small-minded men who criticize your service to seem bigger before their families. I swirl the ice cubes around in my glass and tell my father that even though that I have thought about moving to Ireland like he has suggested for all these years, I bite my nails till they bleed at the corners while he suggests methods of gaining dual citizenship because it will be harder for me than it was for he, because his grandparents were born there and mine were born here. When I drink with my father, we compare tales of violence. He first saw a dead body when he was 10 years old, bloated and being fished out of the Hudson via crane on his bike with his friends on the way to school one day when New York epitomized American urban moral decay. I finish my drink and pour myself some more and see that my father is almost finished himself. He clucks and tells me, take it easy now, and reminds me how slippery a slope drinking can be. I grow gregarious and muse about how the old men at the VFW talk about how much easier the world was when the bad guys wore uniforms. Perhaps this is why we focus so much on the turban in lieu of jack boots or capes or badges, which were nowhere to be seen. He tells me of Jack Eanes, who studied at his college, run by Christian Brothers in the 1980s, who mocked his membership in the Manhattan Gaelic League. One was a bouncer who looked down on him and called him a plastic patty, and my father tells me he worked as a bouncer while studying in the Bronx. My father broke his fingers as he clutched him in a chokehold, and my father and I laugh at his pretentiousness being leveled, his cynical condescension of working class New York shanty Irish folk, like an oppressive yoke being broken violently, sic semper tyranny, as they say. Shuffling into the meetings of AA, it's hard to convey all of this in one sitting as coffee is poured religiously into styrofoam cups and mantras are repeated ritualistically, and the same stories of why we desire to quit are repeated until we no longer remember the feeling truly of why. So I pop in and out at irregular intervals, like Catholics who only observe the high holy days like Easter and Christmas, the birth and death of a Palestinian pacifist from two millennia past. What can I do and what can I say? I drink because it's fun, like sex without a condom on, or shooting guns, or riding fast with no helmet, and praying for the best as the wind cuts my face. My father used to say, a place for everything and a, for everything a place. Well, my mother worked nights after he got home from work himself and had to get us kids to put away our toys. Monumental task. My father sits back on the porch, stirring this time a tonic with gin, on the phone with a very important client from work. And I pour myself another whiskey, because gin makes me feel guilty. The picture of Victoria, famine queen herself, staring dead-eyed out from the label of her blue bottle. Then, when he finishes his call, he hugs me and asks me how my meeting went. I tell him that AA is a cult, and I want no more to do with it. And we drink and tell stories as the flags of America and Kerry and Virginia all flutter gently over the large deck behind his house. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Phil. We've got about 10 minutes left and three poets, so I think we can squeeze them in. So, Gronia O'Connor. So we have coming up.
It's not finished and it mightn't be a poem. There are humans in the stars and I'm eating a Milky Way. I'm in space and I'm eating all the chocolate off the edges. There are more stars than grains of sand and this Milky Way is my treat. They're sending men to Mars and I write down everything I eat. They sleep standing up in spaceships. I want to be less spacious. It takes years to become a spaceman. Only smart people get to be weightless. Less weight on my frame on the floor on anybody else. I start to feel myself moving. I'm starting to forget.
Not finished, there might not be a poem. How do you know the title is my autobiography? Come on. Rabbi Urquhart, please.
We were talking about philosophy, Taoist philosophy, and we were talking about different Taoist philosophers last week in the pub. I kid you not, we were. After the session here last week, we went around to the pub. Anyway, I was given a book, so I've been reading this book. What's your man's name?
Zhuangzi.
What's his name? Zhuangzi. Zhuangzi. Yeah. So I've been reading this. It reminded me of something else. So this is Mencius said this way back in the midst of time. Mencius was. He reinvigorated the Confucian tradition, you know, because Confucius had been dead for about 300 years, and people were kind of like, you know, it was getting a bit scrappy and a bit messy. So Mencius came along, and Mencius got it all back together, and he said this. He said, if you know the point of balance, you can settle the details. If you can settle the details, you can stop running around. Once you stop running around, your mind will become calm. When your mind becomes calm, you can think in front of a tiger. And when you can think in front of a tiger, you will surely succeed.
Thank you. sharp the knife for us.
This one is titled Meaning with a question mark. You have a way with words, she says. I wanted to take it as a compliment, but our circumstances did not allow for a positive interpretation to intersect. My ego saved the conversation, improbable given the relationship that distrust and insecurities we constantly chip. As we spoke, I would coax her to agree about facts that I had never checked. Tu aimes jouer sur les mots. I had made a way with words. Those she had taught me in languages she knew. For her, a duty. For me, a gift to exploit and grow. Certain hard passages, she said, got in the wake of my word, a bridge I crossed as we built it. Every time wider as my vocabulary extended, until I could dance on the tip of my tongue. I have a way with words, but I'm never slick when I speak. They do come around, never stick, as I'm never the master. I follow until I lose them, through my dearest one's heart. To life itself. I'm looking for a way with words.
Alright, I think we've got about 2 minutes left, so I might finish on one of my own. Is that okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
Go on, go on.
So tonight's been a little bit about philosophy, it's been about laughter, it's been about the philosophy of laughter, and my own poetry is often a little bit of an introspective kind of darkness. So this one's about rain clouds and silver linings. And you said you didn't mind the rain clouds when they came, if they only stayed a moment for a deluge of refrain. Said you'd handle all the wet, the musk of petrichor, and we couldn't have the lining if the silver sailed for shore. Said it's not about the cloud, it's what the cloud's about, with a body full of water and a raindrop full of doubt. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you to our two guests, Stephen and Anne. You were absolutely wonderful. Thank you to our band, as always. And I do believe, on our 470th person now, we're going to go to Maine's. Thank you.